National Weather Service. Partly sunny, today's high 37. Tomorrow, problematic. Tomorrow, winter weather advisory in the morning. Looks like another round of rain, freezing rain and snow moving through the area Wednesday morning. They tell us it'll be messy, but little or no accumulation. This morning, the sun is shining, 29 degrees Racine, 27 in Kenosha. Wind from the west-northwest at 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling degree from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. More information is available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Thank you.
I regret very much interrupting wonderful music like that, especially with the composer sitting right here in the studio. This piece, The Summer Day, is by Joan Shimko, who is one of our country's most admired composers. And she is in the area today and tomorrow at the invitation of Dr. Peter Dene, who is the director of Carthage's wonderful women's ensemble. And he is also overseeing the Lakeshore Women's Choral Invitational event, which is going to be occurring tomorrow and culminating in a concert tomorrow afternoon, which is going to feature much of Joan Shimko's beautiful choral music and a world premiere of a piece called Nothing Short of Grace. And so I'm very, very happy that we can spend today's morning show with Dr. Dene and his special guest, which is our special guest for the morning show, composer Joan Shimko. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Dr. Dene, tell us about this invitation, your connection with the composer Joan Shimko, and what makes this possible.
Well, I've known Joan through her music for many, 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 many years, basically since I've been conducting, but had never met her. And a little over a year ago, at the American Choral Directors Association conference in Minneapolis last March, we ran into one another, I think, at an exhibition booth or something, and ended up spending quite a bit of time together, just kind of connected really quickly. And so I talked to her about this festival that I have and the potential of commissioning a work from her to do for the festival, and I think she was very interested in wanting to do that, and so we worked. And I think one thing I want to say about it is there are four women from the area here who helped through monetary support to make this whole thing happen this time, and some wish to remain anonymous, so I think I'll just say that thank you to all four of those women who've supported me in different ways in the past, and this has been a big support to make this happen. And I'm thrilled, and my choir is going to meet Joan tonight, this afternoon, in our rehearsal, and they can't wait for it to happen. And I spent last week visiting. We have five high school choirs coming to work with Joan and to do this premiere. And I spent last week visiting each of those high schools, and the same is true for the directors. Excited to see Joan and those students. So this will be a really neat opportunity.
Great. And explain how her music, that is Joan Shimko's music, specifically figures in tomorrow's concert.
Yeah. In addition to the premiere of this new work, each of the choirs, including my choir, is going to perform one of her works. So there'll be a premiere and then six other pieces from her repertoire of compositions that will be performed. So it's exciting to hear, and they're from all different parts of her career, I think. And one of the things I love about Joan's music is that it's the music and the text are married together. I think mm-hmm. I think that when I think about Joan's style, it's more a style that's connected to whatever the words are.
Absolutely.
Sometimes when you do the music of a composer, it kind of starts to feel like, well, that piece is just like that piece. It's just like, but there was one, I won't say the composer, but there was one time I was at a concert and I found myself singing a different piece along with the one that was being performed. And that's not Joan's music at all. Every piece stands as its own piece. So to come to a concert of Joan's music is to really hear a diversity of style.
Which is not always the case with composers.
Right,
some
exactly.
have an unmistakable style that's sort of stamped on every single piece.
Right.
No matter what.
I think of composers as being flavors.
Yeah.
And some of them are just absolutely yummy flavors.
Yeah.
And I think particularly amongst colleagues, choral composers have created these gorgeous, sonorities. And But again, yeah, like a whole concert of that sonority or that sound is
sometimes can get a
sometimes, depending on how much you like to eat that
right?
Food, right?
You've had enough, right?
That whipped cream or whatever. Yeah.
So it's exciting to hear all and you know there aren't a lot of composers. I mean, there are many composers that you could do this with, but for a genre of women's choral music to have this whole great repertoire for each of us to go and say, okay, which of these, you know, pieces do I want to do? And, you know, that's the thing is, you know, well, do I want to do this one or this one or this one? And there's so many options that's not the case for lots of composers, especially for women's choirs. And it's great to have somebody who is composing literature that at the level that our choirs want to sing at for women's choirs.
Mm. Fantastic. So we're really honored to have you here. I've been a big fan of yours and of your music for a long, long time.
Oh,
so this
you.
Is great that you can be here. Let's get a little bit of your life story, if we may. And I know that you were born in Chicago, and from the sounds of it in your biography, you grew up in an exceedingly musical household in which the influences and the kind of music you were exposed to was quite an amazing array.
It was quite a variety of music. My parents are both first generation Americans, and I think like a lot of people in that generation, they valued education, and I was very fortunate that my parents also valued the arts, and so it was just a given that we were all going to have piano lessons. You know, we all sang in choirs. We grew up in the 60s, for Pete's sake, so there was this influx of, it was the beginning of the whole singer-songwriter. Mm. People don't realize that, but that whole idea of performers singing their own music arrived at that time. So, you know, I had all those influences in my music, but the background sounds were, because my parents, they didn't really let us buy popular music. My mother thought it was a waste of money. Just turn the radio on, she'd say, you know, it's free, it's free. So as far as the music that we, you know, the record albums that you listen to over and over and over again, what we had in the home was classical music, you know, and musicals is what I listened. So that was the background and a lot of influences, yeah. I have a sister who is a painter and is a professor of art, and all of my other siblings, though not working in the arts, have lots of creative outlets. So, yeah, that's true.
Hmm. It was just a given, I think, and this is what you were going to do. You ultimately studied choral conducting, and that was your aspiration more than being a composer, I think.
Well, growing up, I wanted to be a doctor. And I'm going to be honest and say my parents were disappointed when I decided to study music because, you know, it's like it's one thing to want to expose your children to the arts. It's another thing to encourage them to have a career in the arts because it's a challenging road. It really is. And mm-hmm. So they said, okay, yeah, sure, but you have to be able to get a job. So I studied choral music education. I got my degree down U of I in Champaign-Urbana. And I quickly fled the Midwest. That's a story I'm not going to get into. But I moved to Seattle right out of college. And to be quite frank, was a bit lost. I mean, people think of Seattle as this very vibrant city. But in 1979, when I arrived, it was depressed.
Hmm. What drew you there? Anything in particular?
A relationship.
Ah, okay. All right.
I think a lot of people have moved across the country
right. So it was really, for no high artistic aspirations.
No, not at all. But you know, I think people come into your life. They're like, I think of them as kind of guideposts and signposts that they lead the way to something. You don't understand in the moment why. And it really was a blessing to arrive in Seattle, although I floundered a bit for a couple of years doing what I mentioned, Seattle being in this depressed state only because there were no teaching jobs. Mm. And I really only wanted to be a high school choral director. I did not want to teach elementary music. And so I moved around. I did a lot of different things. I worked on sailboats. I worked in restaurants. I was actually, I didn't just realize this a couple of years ago. I was probably one of the very first baristas for Starbucks. Yeah. Mm. I worked at the original Starbucks store at Pike Market. I the delivery truck. I did all kinds of things. And in the middle of all that, again, it was just the circumstance. There was a house around the block who had a party, and they had a grand piano in their living room that nobody was playing. And I hadn't touched a piano in 2 years. And so I said, hey, you know, I just live around the corner. Could I come and practice? And I said, sure. And so it so happened people living in the house belonged to this women's choir that had recently formed.
The Aurora? And,
no, this was the Seattle Women's Ensemble.
Oh, okay.
And this was the early 80s. It was a lesbian feminist choir, and they sang a lot of social justice music. It was kind of communally run. They didn't have any leaders. They had, if you wanted to conduct, you could. It was a very interesting situation, very different from my. I think things are different now in terms of how people are educated. But you know, I'm of the age where it was a very hierarchical, top down, dominant, you know, director. You know, so even learning how to be a leader and to be someone who inspires people within that environment was really important. And so I threw myself into this. I mean, I was doing it for, I was for free, you know. Yeah. But boy, what an education did I get. Mm. And because of the kind of repertoire that this group sang, you couldn't go to the, okay, this is before the internet, right? And you were lucky if you had a good sheet music store in your town, right? And you would just go and you would just pull from whatever was on the shelves. And it became very clear to me that there was absolutely nothing of value for women's choir on the shelf, because I was really determined with my background to build this ensemble, to present concert literature as well as literature that was about justice and lifting the human spirit. I wanted to lift spirits just for the beauty of choral music. And so I started by arranging music, and I had done some songwriting, you know, but I had no idea I was going to become a composer. All I really wanted to do is I just wanted to explore music, because it had such a powerful impact on me as a young person, and I just wanted to work within that ocean of music, right? Hmm. So I started creating original works, and what I discovered as a composer is that I had from my back, I'm not going to go into a bunch of family background, but I had been raised a very devout Catholic. And there was a split between me and my faith and me and my family. And composing music was it was like a spiritual experience, I'll be quite frank. I felt a communion with spirit in a way that I had not ever. Hmm. And so my belief was, this is how I feel when I'm doing this. I know that I am loved. I know that I'm okay. Let's put it that way. And so I really poured myself into that, and found that to my surprise and delight, that the music that I was writing was very, people were very, the singers were very moved by, and the audience was as well. So this group that I actually spent 10 years with, and along the way, I never went back to get a graduate degree. But what I did do is any master classes, workshops, whatever, I was definitely a student of choral conducting, and of vocal production, because as Peter would tell you, I mean, you are, for many of the people in your choirs, their only voice teacher. So I really threw myself in understanding of voice, of conducting, and all of that. And I came to a point, I collaborated on a music theater piece with a friend. and I wrote a musical, which in some actually in some ways I think my what I would really love to still go towards is music theater, opera, that kind of thing, because my music is very dramatic, and it is very much about the text.
Right.
But anyway, I had this musical. It was produced in Seattle. I had a blast. It was so fun. And I said, this is what I want to do. So I dropped everything and went to live on an island for for 2 years. I mean, it sounds very remote, but actually it's Vashon Islands and is off of West Seattle. And I lived very simply for 2 years. I got a little mini grant to write a piece of music. And I thought, okay, the universe is affirming this decision, and it actually was probably two of the most wonderful years of my life. I wrote another musical that nothing came of, but I wrote another musical, other things. I had a church choir, and I performed in an African marimba ensemble. I had discovered, actually I did go back to school to U of I for a year to become recertified to teach. And I rediscovered my love of African music. Actually, one of the pieces that we were talking earlier about, the albums that you had at home that you listened to over and over again, you know, one of those was the Misa Luba. Do you know that piece? But I had always been driven by rhythm. I wanted to join the band. I wanted to be a drummer. My parents said, you've already had 3 years of piano lessons. but who wants their kid banging on a snare drum and right in the basement? But I always wanted to drum, and I actually do drum today. But I discovered this love of rhythm and studied African hand drumming, Western African hand drumming, and I heard this marimba ensemble in Seattle, which I believe is still going on Zanga, marimba ensemble, and I had to do it. And so I went and I took the class, and then I became a member, and I did that for 2 years. And then I realized that I was missing the choir rehearsal room. And good timing, a colleague in Portland said, hey, I hear you're just sitting around writing music. What a waste. meaning he knew me as a choral director, right? And so he had a job for me. He wanted me to take over one of his choirs down in Portland. And long story short, I did move to Portland, and that is the Aurora Chorus that you're speaking of which next year will be my 25th season with Aurora, which is really hard to believe. But while in Portland, I came down to lead Aurora, but then I founded very quickly that select ensemble that you heard on that first clip, Veritas Vocal Ensemble. I also began a relationship with a dance movement theater company called Do Jump. And for over a decade, collaborated with Robin Lane. And that's a whole nother hour conversation talking about Robin and that work. But what I was writing was basically word. It's funny because for someone who's so attached to text and so driven by text, I was writing primarily wordless vocal music and other instrumental music for this ensemble, and had the opportunity to perform, to sing with the group. And I had a select group from Veritas. We would do live performances in live shows. And we're talking about aerialists, you know, again, gymnastics and influenced choreography, all this live stuff. It was very thrilling. I got to perform on Broadway with a company at the Kennedy Center, at the Geffen LA, doing this music. So I was juggling a lot of balls, and I think I got a little burnt out. And you know, I'm looking at Peter, and he's not even doing. I know what you're talking about. And so, kind of in the aughts, I trimmed things down. I was starting. I had been published, I think, at the end of the '90s with Santa Barbara Music, and she just started like publishing everything I sent her. It was kind of amazing. Almost everything I sent her. And because I always wrote for my own choirs, I mean, what an opportunity. It's like having a composing lab, right? And I learned so much. You know, it's just this immediate feedback, right?
Sure.
So I had a lot of literature for women's choir. And so I think in the, you know, North American choral world, I am known very much for my literature for women's choir, because getting back to what I said a few minutes ago, when I started out in the 80s, there was basically really fluffy arrangements of pop music, very little, for lack of a better term, serious concert literature, very little texts that were engaging, empowering, interesting.
Right.
Yeah. And I started doing that to fill a need, both a need of my choirs and, I guess, my own need for expression. And, you know, as a choral composer, you're always on the lookout for texts. And so I developed an interest for poetry, and I'm always looking for texts. And now I'm being my nonlinear self, and I'm not quite sure where I'm going. So maybe you can guide this. Oh, talking about do jump and all these things that I was juggling, and so I kind of pared it down to just doing a Aurora Chorus. It's a large community chorus. For many years, was over 100 singers, and this was a group that was founded because there's so many women who want to sing, many more women than men who want to sing in a choral ensemble, and there are also a lot of women who want to sing who are afraid of auditions, right? Either because they don't sight read or they're afraid their voices aren't good enough, and so Aurora Chorus was this open arm saying,
Come sing.
If you can match pitch and if you can hold your part, you're in. So Aurora has always been a diverse group of women, both in terms of skill level, but also from various walks of life. The mission of the group has always been to sing with the intention that choral music can be a force for good in the world. Aurora Chorus is also very much about giving, literally and figuratively, giving voice to women. Women's voices matter. And I've also written a lot of music for Aurora Chorus, which I think one of them is on your set list there. I Dream a World, I think I wrote for Aurora.
Yes, I'd love to play that, actually.
Okay.
And one of the things I want to say, too, before we hear it, is that one of the things I appreciate about the way you write is that, you know, not only was there for a long time there probably just a lot of fluff written for women's groups, but also maybe someone would take a chorus from some work that was intended to be SATB and arrange it for just women's voices.
Right, and it doesn't always translate, does
it? Well, and in many cases, you find yourself very conscious of what isn't there.
Yeah.
And when I listen to just about anything that you've written, I never feel like I'm missing men's voices.
Thank you, yeah.
It feels utterly complete in the same way that a really skilled composer who maybe writes for, let's say, string orchestra, possible to do that, and you don't sit there missing the clarinets or missing the brass or whatever.
Well, you know, I always, altos love me because I've always given altos juicy parts, mezzos also. And again, early with my early a cappella arrangements that I did, I had a bass line in there. You know, I had women who could sing, you know, G's pretty easily, but I always wanted to. Thank you for that, for that observation. It always felt like there was a bottom missing, and it wasn't necessarily the bass line. It was just
filling it out.
Well, let's hear a little bit of this piece you mentioned called I Dream of a World. This happens to be a recording by the San Francisco Girls Chorus. This was I Dream a World by Joan Shimko. That was the San Francisco Girls Chorus. We're speaking with Joan Shimko, who is the distinguished guest of the Carthage Music Department and Dr. Peter Dene for the Lakeside Choral Women's Choral Invitational. That event is tomorrow and culminating in a concert tomorrow night, tomorrow afternoon, I should say, in which a number of pieces by Joan Shimko will be featured. Joan Shimko, one of the things you do besides writing so beautifully for The Voice and especially for women's voices, although you certainly have written mixed choral pieces as well.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, but
and for men's choir too,
yeah,
right?
For men's too.
Yeah,
not as much for men.
Absolutely.
But yeah,
yeah, but certainly a lot of people think of you, especially for the wonderful pieces you've written to enhance the repertoire of women's groups. You also, I think, quite often make marvelous use of instruments. And we're going to hear an example of that in just a moment.
Uh-huh.
But I want to just have you say a brief word about how you make those choices when you do decide to utilize instruments with voices.
In terms of the orchestration, as a choice of instrument?
Right,
or?
Right. I mean, what kinds of things do you think about in terms of this is this piece needs this?
Well, I think that, and I'm not alone in this choice. I think that cello and women's voices is a really lovely combination. We talked earlier about depth. I don't know if that was on air or off air, but that in a lot of treble music, you don't feel that it's complete somehow.
Yeah.
I just think just in terms of balancing. I think women's voices can be cool. I think particularly young women's voices have a cool quality to them. I think as more mature voices develop a warmer quality. But the cello just has that warmth always that can be added. So I think some of my early pieces, and I think it's just kind of that, you know, beginner, I'm going to write for the instrument that I love, you know? So I think that one of my first pieces was called This We Know, and I wrote it for cello and oboe because I just loved cello and oboe together. And I've written a couple other pieces with cello and oboe. But in general, this is a great question. I just recently, speaking of mixed chorus, I wrote a large full concert length piece, 70-minute piece for chorus, mixed chorus and orchestra and solely on the subject of Alzheimer's dementia.
Shadow and Light.
And it was, I have written for almost, except for not euphonium, I've not written for euphonium,
that's my instrument.
But I've written for almost every instrument as an obbligato or in a small chamber thing, but I had not written for full orchestra, which is a totally different animal and balancing issues and just a lot to think about. And so I had to make those choices a lot. And I think of instruments as voices. To be perfectly honest, I and in a lot of my compose, particularly for chorus, people say, "Well, how do you compose? Do you compose at the piano, or you know, what do you do?" Vocal music, I compose by singing. You know, the piece that you're going to premiere,
right. Yeah.
I didn't plunk that out, that melody out. I create melody with my own voice, and for instrumental parts, I often will sing them and see how they feel. And I think if you put it in your own voice, you can get a sense of where it's going to, how it's going to best express.
Right.
So again, instrumentation, I'm not quite sure which piece you're going to play, but I mean, there's choices that you can make as pure accompaniment. Obviously, choral pieces have a lot of piano accompaniment, keyboard accompaniment. And in writing for piano, I never want the piano just to be an accompaniment. I want the piano to be an integral part of the piece. It has a voice. It has its own voice, and it helps tell the story, right? That said, there are some pieces, I don't know which one you're going to play, but I know on your set list you said The Roses. I knew you were going to say that. The Roses, which I wrote for accordion.
Oh, cool.
And the reason why I chose accordion is because, the text is, you know, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. That's the whole text, which people may forget that that was actually came from Gertrude Stein, but it's also just become kind of an adage. Yeah. It's right, it's a public domain adage. But I, the feeling I had from it is just the image that I had was just kind of like this cafe with roses overflowing, and I'm thinking about Gertrude Stein being in Paris, and so I had so the opening is kind of this funky waltz with kind of a French cafe feeling with the accordion, and also I wanted to just write just a fun, I write so much, you know, forgive me, but serious music, you know. And I just wanted to write something that was just about delight. And what is more delightful than an accordion?
It's true. Here's a little bit of this wonderful piece. It is delightful, called The Roses by Joan Shimko. That piece is called The Roses by Joan Shimko, and what a delight. So before we run out of time, we need to hear a little bit about the piece that is going to receive its world premiere on tomorrow afternoon's concert called Nothing Short of Grace. I'm afraid we just have a couple minutes to talk about it, but where did the text come from, and what else should we know about this piece?
Right. The text was actually inspired by a kind of a meditation poem by a woman, Dana Falds. And I loved this idea of let me back up a little bit. I just in the past year, I have been asking myself, you know, what can I do in this current, I'll just call it climate, cultural, political climate. And, you know, post the Me Too movement, or not even post, you know, no, within this this moment, what can I do? And, you know, we've been talking about how much of my composing career has been about providing, you know, challenging, muscular, engaging music for a women's chorus. But I also have written a lot of music that is very empowering to women. And so I started a choral series called Dare to be Powerful. And that comes from a quote by Audre Lorde, Black African-American poet, who said, when I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I'm afraid. And so I had to say, well, what is my strength? And it has been, you know, writing this literature for a women's chorus. And so when Peter asked me to do this commission, he specifically said, I'd really like something that is fitting into your Dare to be Powerful series. So basically, this is a very simple piece. It's the text is, to take one step takes courage. To take one step takes heart, but to keep going, never knowing what may lie ahead, to choose the unknown and look fear in the face, that is nothing short of grace.
And the next verse says, sister, keep going.
Sister, keep going. Right, exactly. Yeah. And so the musically, it has a, again, speaking of the accompaniment as being a voice, I mean, yes, it is providing a very simple harmonic, and it's a simple piece harmonically, but the accompaniment has this rhythm, this lilting kind of a moving forward rhythm, and the vocal line is kind of, it's hesitant.
That's exactly what I've been telling all the other choirs. I'm glad to hear you say that.
And that's exactly, I mean, it's because that's how you feel. It's like, you know, taking that one step forward. Should I do it? Put in your foot in the water, you know, whatever it is. You know, there are people who just dive in, and for many of us, it's like, you know. So the piece has that quality to it, but it really coalesces and becomes a really, there's these strong moments where as a whole, the group is finding that courage and moving forward.
It sounds amazing. That will be, I assume, the kind of culminating moment of tomorrow's concert.
That last piece on the concert, over 300 singers.
Oh, my gosh. So explain, Dr. Dene, where and especially when tomorrow's concert is going to happen for those.
So the concert is, because we have five high school choirs coming, it's during the day, it's not an evening concert. It's originally scheduled for 4:30. But it looks as though there's going to be a lot of snow around that time tomorrow. And you know, everybody's got school buses, and they're all over an hour away from Carthage. So I'm going to move it to 4:10. 4:10 is a weird time, but that's what time the women's ensemble rehearsal starts. And so that's when I can get my choir to be there. So it's at 4:10 in the chapel tomorrow. Prairie Ridge High School from Illinois, Crystal Lake High School from Illinois, Pewaukee High School, Germantown High School, and Muskego High School will all be present and performing. So throughout the day, we'll have different – they each have 45 minutes with Joan to work on their music. They're going to have a vocal workshop with one of our voice faculty. They'll have a tour of the college. There may be a flash mob happening around 12:30 in the cafeteria. So there's things that they'll be doing throughout the day, but the concert's at 4:10. It's also live streamed. So if you go to Carthage, if you just type in on Google Carthage live stream, it'll pop up on your computer if you want to see the concert online.
So one way or another, this is something not to miss.
That just reminds me, maybe I'll have trouble getting the live stream to start at 4:10, so I have to figure that out, too.
There you go.
Thank you.
So somebody has to press a button. Well, in the meantime, what an exciting event, and how exciting that composer Joan Chimko can be part of it. And Joan Chimko, I was so glad that you could be part of today's morning show as well.
Oh,
it was
great
to
learn
something about the woman behind all of this great music and some about your story. And we certainly wish you well with your participation in this exciting event tomorrow. And again, thank you for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Composer Joan Chimko and Dr. Peter Dene, her host at Carthage College. And we're finishing out with a little bit of one of her most famous works, It Takes a Village. Tomorrow on the morning show, Lisa Kornetsky from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside will be talking about the play Eurydice by Sarah Ruhl, which will be opening this weekend. And this will be Lisa Kornetsky's final production at Parkside. She retires at the end of this school year. So we'll take the opportunity to also look back at her.